You've heard of BetaShares. You've probably seen the logo on our podcast. You might even be among their 1 million investors. So you can imagine that I'm delighted to say BetaShares is the official ETF partner of the Australian Finance Podcast. With nearly 100 exchange-traded funds, you can go to betashares.com.au and immerse yourself in ETFs and unique insights covering all of the sectors, themes, core and satellite positions you could want. Think cybersecurity through the HACK ETF, robotics and AI with the RBTZ ETF, and uranium with the URNM ETF. The list goes on. To explore the BetaShares ETF range, visit betashares.com.au, read the relevant PDS and TMD on the website, and consider if the fund is right for you. BetaShares Capital Limited is the issuer.
Hey there, here's a quick note. This podcast contains general financial advice only. That means it's not specific to you, your needs, goals, or objectives, so don't act on the information until you've spoken with your financial advisor. You'll find our full disclosure, disclaimer, and link to our financial services guide in the show notes.
This year, I've become really interested in the idea of using my time better and ways to live my life with more intention. There is so much more to our lives than picking the perfect ETF or brokerage account. So I think it's important that we take the time to zoom out and look at the bigger picture of how we're designing the lives we want to live and investing both our time and money better. So I'm excited to introduce today's guest, Dr. Amantha Imber, who is an organisational psychologist and behavioural scientist. Amantha has just released her book, TimeWise, which is a guide designed to help dominate your day and level up your life, using the secrets and habits from the world's most successful people. She's also the host of popular podcast How I Work, where she interviews some of the world's most successful people about their habits, rituals, and strategies for optimizing their day. So in today's episode, we're going to be discussing ways to invest both your time and money better, whether money can buy happiness, and how to make better decisions when spending money and time. Amantha, thank you so much for joining me on the Australian Finance Podcast today.
It's good to be here.
It is wonderful to do another in-person episode. We were just talking off air about how fun it is to actually meet guests in person.
It's so different. And I feel like, I know for me on the How I Work podcast, I've just got back to doing face-to-face interviews and it's just, it's a different level of rapport I think you can build with guests. So I love it too.
Yeah. And I think we've all had enough of Zoom or Google Meet over the last couple of years.
Yes, definitely.
And you've just launched a book last week, this week?
A week ago, yeah. Yes.
How's it all going?
It is great. It's a bit of a blur of bookstore visits and interviews and media stuff, but it's been great. Like, I mean, when you write a book, it's almost like you're in a cave for a year and you may be getting feedback from one or two people that visit you in the cave who are your editors and they mark up your work like crazy and then you emerge from the cave and it's kind of like, oh, people are actually going to read this thing that I've been working on a lot for the last year. So it's quite exciting.
Yeah. I know a lot of people, including myself, have the dream to one day write a book. So it's quite crazy that you've got a physical, tangible book that people can buy now.
Yes. It's always weird when you receive that physical copy. It's like, oh my God, it's real. It wasn't just in my imagination. So that's always exciting.
Yeah. Well, I'm excited to dig into the book and other things you've done in today's episode. But given we're a finance podcast and we talk a lot about investing your time and money better, I wanted to kick off with the question that I've been thinking a lot about recently, and it's whether money can buy happiness, and if so, to what extent?
Well, from a research point of view, it can. So there's definitely a correlation up to, I think it's about $75,000 a year that money can make you happier. Then research has said it just plateaus after that. But recent research has said, no, it still actually does go up a bit. But I think it's where the happiness can come is how we use money. So, and I guess this is quite a privileged conversation as well, because not everyone has discretionary spend. But to give you an example, like something I do in my own life is I think about how am I using my time in a way that is not the best use, or doing things that frustrate me or irritate me or things that I just don't like doing. So as an example, a few years ago, I – It's pre-COVID. My daughter and I used to go to an inner city market in Melbourne, food market, and do our shopping for the week every Saturday. And we are big fruit and vegetable consumers. I think between us, we would probably have like 15 serves a day, something crazy, mental, right? And so what I would do is I love being organized and doing food prep in advance. I feel that that's quite an efficient thing to do. But I would literally spend hours in the kitchen after the market visit washing vegetables and fruit and cutting them up and packing them into Tupperware. And one day I was just having a big whinge to my now ex-husband about this. And he said, why don't you just put an ad on Airtasker? Surely someone could do this for you. And that was a bit of an aha moment for me. And I'm like, yes, they could, couldn't they? And so I found this amazing university student who had a part-time job doing food prep in a cafe. She had great knife skills, a lot better than mine. And so I then started to have her come around for a couple of hours because she was much quicker than I was, cutting and doing the food prep of the fruit and veggies for a couple of hours every Saturday. I'd pay her $50, and that was the best $50 I spent. Like, I could go out for a meal or get takeaway food or something like that for probably more money than that, but I would much prefer to win back that time and do it, like, do something more meaningful with that time, like play, you know, Lego or some imaginary game with my daughter's toys for a few hours that I was saving through that use of $50.
Yeah. Yeah. We talk a lot about figuring out what your values are and actually using your time and money in line with those values, but it does require a bit of time to actually work out how you should actually use these resources you have wisely.
It certainly does. And I think that, like, something that maybe some listeners know about is that we think that buying products is a good use of time and money, and certainly sometimes it is. But research would suggest that if we can spend more money on experiences rather than products, that's definitely going to lead to more happiness. So why that is experiences are generally meeting a higher order need, like social connection or growth or something like that. Products generally don't meet that kind of a need. And also experiences tend to create memories, whereas products less so. So if we can also skew our spending to experiences, that's a good thing. I can give you one final tip in terms of buying happiness with money. Is like with credit cards, the thing with credit cards, as we all know, is you buy now and pay later. But if we can actually pay now and consume later, we're going to get more happiness. Like, a classic example of this is a holiday. I strongly recommend don't do last-minute holidays because you're missing out on a good chunk of happiness. So, when researchers have looked at when is our peak happiness during the holiday period, from planning through to having the holiday through to after the holiday, the peak happiness often happens in the anticipation leading up to the holiday. So it's a really good idea when you're buying an experience to book it a little bit out, like ideally a few weeks, if not a few months out, because then you maximize the happiness that you're going to experience. Ironically, the lowest levels of happiness are on the actual holiday. And then we get a bit of a boost in happiness when we look back at the holiday.
Yeah, it's interesting. We get so much, we actually get a lot of happiness, even just in the office right now. We're talking about holidays in January, but we're already thinking, oh, where are we going to go, and researching places and talking to people in the office. So this stuff doesn't cost any money, but it's bringing you a lot of happiness in the meantime. So that's quite interesting. And it'll be interesting to hear from listeners if they have done the plan for a year in advance versus a last-minute holiday, the difference in happiness that gave them.
Definitely.
Now, given your book's called Time Wise, and I feel like we often feel time poor, what are some ways that we can feel like we've got more time in our day, our week, and our month if we're feeling like we're getting to the end of every week and going, where did my time go?
It is a very common response, I feel like, to a work day, to finish the day and go, what did I actually get done today? I'm imagining you've maybe had that experience yourself.
Yeah, even during sort of a month and you go, what happened this month? It just flew past. Like, this year's flying really quickly.
Yeah, it absolutely is. I'm almost like, oh, what month are we in? Oh, July.
In July.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yes, that's right. We're halfway through winter in Melbourne. That I do know. so, look, there's a lot of I think there's a lot of actionable tips in TimeWise to solve that challenge around using our time more wisely and more intentionally. But one that I specifically love in terms of overcoming that problem of getting to the end of the day or the end of the week or the end of the month and going, oh my gosh, what did I actually achieve? What did I actually do? Comes from this guy called Jake Knapp. And Jake used to work at Google and Google Ventures, which is their investment arm. And he's thought a lot about time. And Jake, when he was at Google, he used to be ruled by his to-do list. So his life was pretty much just going through his to-do list and ticking off items. And he would kind of get to the end of the day and it would feel just not very meaningful and not very memorable. And so he decided to experiment with something else. So instead of just the day being ruled by his to-do list, what he thought is, he thought, wouldn't it be great to reflect on every day and go, this was the highlight of today. And so what he does is at the beginning of the day, he thinks, what would I like that highlight to be? What would I like to reflect back on at night and go, I did that and that was really cool. And then he'll schedule that in his diary. It's typically a 60 to 90 minute task or project or activity that the highlight will be. And that will be his priority. So above anything else that day, he will make sure he gets that highlight done.
So reverse engineering his day in a way.
Exactly, exactly. Reverse engineering the day so that he guarantees there will be a highlight of the day. And often it's a work highlight, but other times it might be something in his personal life as well. So I think he does this on weekends too. And so I think it's a really great strategy to think about when you start your day, thinking about yourself at the end of the day and going, what would I like today's highlight to be? And putting that in your diary.
Yeah. That might help me because I've tried so many times to get away from the endless to-do list. And I've tried calendar blocking after reading Indistractable by Nir Eyal last year. And we actually interviewed him on the podcast. But I just cannot seem to get away from the endless to-do list. I don't know if you've got any tips for me.
The endless to-do list. I do have a few chapters in TimeWise about to-do lists because I'm a big fan of to-do lists. But one of my favorite tips in the book about to-do lists comes from Rachel Botsman, and she's kind of like a global thought leader around trust and technology. She's a trust fellow at Oxford University. And something that she started doing and doing more frequently when the pandemic hit is actually creating a to-don't list. So she used to do this about once a year where she would think about, you know, her year and go, what does she not want to do the following year? But she realized when the pandemic hit and she stopped spending a lot of her life on a plane and doing traveling is how much she really hated traveling and how much she really liked being at home. And so she started this monthly ritual where at the end of every month, she'll reflect on the month that has just gone and she will think about what are the things that really drained her of energy and she'll put them on her to-don't list. So I love that strategy. I've adopted a similar kind of strategy where on the first Monday of every month, I've literally got 4 to 5 o'clock in the afternoon blocked out to do a reflection on the month that has just gone and think about, okay, what sucked me of energy and what do I just not want to do?
And if you find a few things on those lists and some things that you might actually have to keep doing, like your financial admin or things like that, how do you manage that? Is that something you try to outsource or is there a way to bring more, joy to your financial admin?
Something I think a lot about is what's the best use of my time. There's a chapter in the book about thinking, you know, with the way that you use your time, particularly with work, but also non-work activities. And, you know, often our life admin and finance admin is something that actually falls in non-work hours, I guess, in a lot of people's minds.
Yeah.
Is thinking about, and this comes from Perry Marshall, who's an American, quite famous business consultant. And he says, think about what are the $10 an hour tasks that you do, the $100 an hour tasks that you do, the $1,000 an hour tasks that you do, and the $10,000 an hour tasks that you do. So really thinking, what is the most valuable use of your time and your skills and what is the least valuable? And I'd say for a lot of people, doing financial admin is probably not a good use of people's time. And particularly, you know, if it's doing things that are repetitive, or if you could write a process for somebody else to follow, like a virtual assistant, it can be a really good idea to outsource those $10 an hour tasks. So if, for example, something I think about, and we've got an amazing virtual assistant at Inventium, which is the behavioral science consultancy I founded 15 years ago, is for, I think, the last 5 years, we've had Elaine. And whenever anyone on the team is like becomes aware of a task that's quite administrative in nature, but also quite repetitive, quite monotonous, it would be not too difficult to develop a process or a procedure for somebody else to follow. We always encourage people to do that and give it to Elaine, who's amazing. You know, the rate that we pay her, she's located in the Philippines. We absolutely pay her above market rate. But when we compare that to the Australian economy, it's much more cost effective. So I think, you know, like you don't have to have your employer pay for a virtual assistant. I think that people just in their personal lives can really benefit from finding someone who is in an economy that's different from the Australian economy, still pay that person a really good wage or salary or hourly rate, and remove a lot of things that are just not the best use of our time.
Yeah. And what if we had some things that we couldn't outsource? Maybe we have to call the bank personally to renegotiate our mortgage, and that could be a $10,000 an hour task. Do you recommend like bunching a few of these things up and just getting them out of the way once a month?
Yeah. Look, batching like tasks with like tasks is definitely a good productivity strategy. Like, for example, batch processing emails is quite a common productivity hack. A less common productivity hack is batching meetings together, which I write about in TimeWise, because if we have meetings scattered throughout the day, our research has found that we actually become 22% less productive in the hour leading up to that meeting.
I believe that stat. They can be very disruptive.
Yes, they can be. And it's like you don't really want to get into flow or, you know, do any kind of deep focused work because you're just going to get jolted out of it by the meeting. And likewise, with life admin tasks, like getting on the phone to your bank, for example, there might be a few life admin tasks that you've been putting off, and then, you know, maybe having like an hour of power at the end of the month, or, you know, maybe if they're tasks that you find really hard to do, maybe scheduling it for when you've got peak energy. For, you know, most people, that's in the morning. That can be a really good thing to do.
Yeah. And if we want to start making better decisions, because we talk about making good financial decisions a lot, but maybe just better decisions in general with our, the way we allocate our time and our money. Do you have some strategies that listeners could try out?
Definitely. I think a lot about decision making, and there are a few chapters in TimeWise that are all about very simple ways to make better decisions. One of my favorites comes from Turiya Pitt, and something she was kind of realizing was an issue in her life is that she would get asked to do things, like, let's say, speak at an event in 6 months' time. And in 6 months' time, most of our calendars look pretty empty, like there's not much going on. And so we're like, okay, I'll say yes, because life is quiet then, so I feel fine about that. But then what inevitably happens is our diary fills up and the event comes around and we're like, why did I say yes to that? It's the last thing I feel like doing. So what Turiya does is she has a rule that she calls the next Tuesday rule, where she will ask herself, if this thing that I'm being asked to do, to spend my time on, is like was happening next Tuesday, how would I feel about it? And if she'd feel really excited if it was happening next Tuesday, she says yes. But if she, you know, would feel anything less than excited, she says no. And I think it's a really good gauge. Like, you know, it might be a party even in our social life that we're being invited to. It might be attending a conference for work. It could be all sorts of things that take up time, whether that be in our work or our personal lives. So think about how would you feel if it was happening next Tuesday when your diary is probably pretty crazy busy.
I like that one.
Yeah, it's going to feel good or bad.
Easier to say yes to something if we don't pay the price in time or money until 6 months in the future. Whereas if we thought about it, what's going to actually happen next week? No, I think I'll try that one out. I like it. Was there any others?
There's another one that I really like from John Zaratsky, who's also an ex-Googler like Jake. They used to work together. And he has a strategy that he calls the iceberg yes. It's kind of tapping into a similar thing, because often when we get asked to do something, we can often just focus on the exciting part of it. And like a presentation is a really easy example to give. If we're asked to give a presentation, we can think about, you know, being in the glory of all those people and, you know, the audience coming up to us afterwards and going, that was great. And it can be really tempting to say yes when you focus on just the tip of the iceberg, the exciting part of the thing that you're being asked to do. But what we forget is everything that lies below the surface, all the hard work that is involved in the lead up to doing that thing that we're being asked to do. So I had this happen to me a few years ago. I have this happen to me a lot, and I use this strategy a lot because I feel like I can be sucked in by shiny objects. But I was asked to be on this committee for a prestigious business school to review their MBA program. And I thought about, oh, that sounds like lots of glory involved in that and lots of impact that I can have on these future MBA students, some of which we had employed. And so I said yes immediately. I didn't think it through. But what I didn't think about is what sat below the iceberg, which was tens of hours of meetings in a stuffy university boardroom where minimal progress got made and where lots of different voices and points of view wanted to be heard. And I just got to the end of those meetings and thought, what have I said yes to? This is killing me. So I love the iceberg yes, because it helps avoid all the stuff that sits below the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, I feel like that could be quite useful for our finances as well, because we often get involved in something just because of the shiny object at the top, and we don't actually properly think through the decision and all the intricacies involved below it.
Absolutely. Yes, yes. I think you can apply it to so many things in life to make better decisions.
Awesome. Now, I hear you've got some thoughts on why our current method of goal setting is broken.
Yes. So goal setting, and particularly SMART goals, are quite popular in productivity circles. And
I remember that from high school.
Yeah. Good old SMART goals. Turns out they're not so smart. So when we think about goal setting, and I got this advice from Professor Adam Alter, who's a professor at the Stern School of Business at NYU. And he says goal setting is broken, because when we set a goal, and let's just say it's to like save up, I don't know, $50,000 for a deposit on a home. Until you reach that goal, until you have $50,000 or whatever your goal is saved up in the bank, you are failing. You are failing. When you've saved up $40,000, you're still failing. And that is a really demotivating state to be in. And then when we hit the goal, sure, we've got success, but how often do we, like, you know, really truly celebrate success and sit in that success for a long time? We don't. We just move on to the next goal. And so we're back into a failure state. So what Adam says is a much better way to approach goals is, sure, have an idea of your end point, but instead of focusing on that, focus on setting a system that's ideally a daily or weekly system that will ultimately get you to that end point. So it might be a system for saving up for a deposit on a home, might be going, every week I'm only going to have, one coffee rather than two, and I'm going to put that, you know, $30 or $40 or however much it equates to into a savings account. And I know that if I do that every week for X number of weeks, that I'm eventually going to reach that goal. So think about, what is your system? Maybe your system is saving a percentage of your salary every week and putting that straight into account. So, you can apply it to all sorts of things. Like a work goal might be, I have to write this report, and instead of just focusing on the end state of this report that you're failing at until that report is written and delivered, think about, okay, well, every day I'm going to spend half an hour on working on this report, or every day I'm going to write 200 quality words that are going to contribute to this report, and I know that by this point in time I will have got to that end point because the system gets me there.
Yeah, I think that's quite good, because the financial goals we set can often seem very overwhelming at the start, especially for listeners who are saving up for a house deposit or wanting to build their portfolio. And so, yeah, you can feel like you're never really reaching that goal until you finally hit that number. And that could be 5 or 10 years down the track, but you don't get to enjoy all those small milestones in the meantime.
Exactly. You can celebrate a system every day if it's a daily system and you're sticking to it.
And what if something happens and you realize you're not on track to reach your goals? Because I guess even with those SMART goals, when they're realistic, sometimes life changes and you end up not actually achieving the goal at the pace you thought. What would you do to sort of reframe or change your goals so you can still achieve something?
I would actually relook at the system. Yeah. So if your life has changed and you're like, I don't think that system is actually achievable now on a daily basis, I would reflect on, well, what does seem achievable given my life has changed? So it might mean that it's going to take longer to get to that end state, but you're not going to be beating yourself up if you're kind of missing that daily system. So review the system as opposed to the end state, because presumably there's a reason for the end state.
Yeah. Yeah. And our emotions play a big role in goal setting and decision making, and sometimes they play a role to our detriment. And so what are some ways we can overcome maybe things that are making us procrastinate or put off doing certain tasks or working towards certain goals?
There is a lot about procrastination in the book. There's particularly a lot around digital distraction and being really attached to our devices. So one of my favorite strategies in the book comes from Kevin Rose, and he's quite a high profile venture capitalist in Silicon Valley. And he became aware of just how often he was reaching for his phone quite mindlessly for no purpose other than just to pick it up out of habit. And when he looked at his behavior, he was picking up his phone 100 times a day or thereabouts, which is actually not that much. The average person picks up their phone about 200 times
a
day.
That is terrifying.
Terrifying. It's so terrifying.
I probably do it too.
But at least you haven't during this podcast interview, which is very polite. So he thought about how could he reduce those mindless pickups and mindless checking of his phone. And so what he did is he got a rubber band and he tied it around his phone horizontally. And so what it would mean is that he couldn't actually unlock his phone to check it without removing the rubber band. So putting an obstacle in the way, which made him think twice about, do I really actually need to check my phone? And so through that very simple strategy, he reduced his pickups from 100 per day to 30 per day. And if you want to get really hardcore, get a second rubber band and like make a cross with the rubber bands. I have tried that, and that really does put you off picking up your phone.
Okay, I'll definitely give that one a go, because yeah, you just do it in moments where you want to fill the silence or fill the void. When you're just waiting for your coffee, suddenly you're looking at your phone, not for any particular reason. It just becomes a habit.
Oh my gosh, it does. It does. And look, another thing that I found really useful for myself, which this is also in the book, it's around creating a distraction-free phone. So basically creating a boring phone, because why phones are very exciting is because most people have lots of social media apps on their phone and lots of apps that have an endless scroll that you never, ever get to the end of. And we also have apps like our email account, which we can check and find out how many people love us and want something from us, and that makes us feel really good. And so if you can think about what are all the apps on your phone that are hijacking your attention and that you're finding really compelling and engaging, and basically delete all those apps off your phone, you will create a very boring phone, and you'll just be left with your sort of utilitarian apps, things that are actually useful, like your torch or the weather. And it's like, you know, there's only so much time you can spend looking at the weather app before you just switch off your phone. So,
yeah. My current hypothesis is that apps like TikTok and Instagram and Uber Eats and Netflix are killing our ability to focus. I haven't looked at any of the science behind that, but it's what I'm blaming for not being able to read my law textbook for 5 hours at once. Is there any truth behind that?
Oh, there's so much truth behind that. Yeah. And I mean, like the apps are designed in a way to to grab our attention. They use, and I'm sure if you had Nia Eyal on the show, I know Nia somewhat well. He would have spoken about this in that the way apps are designed, they're designed on what's called an intermittent reinforcement schedule, where we don't get a reward every time we look at the app. Like, there's not always a new like of the really cute picture that we just posted, but there sometimes is. It's intermittent or random. And that's the most addictive, positive reinforcement schedule that we can create. It's like how pokies are designed. And, you know, look, any kind of gambling device is designed to give you rewards sometimes, but you don't know when. It's completely unpredictable, which brings you back for more and more and more. It's actually far less addictive if you get a reward every single time. So they're deliberately designed in that way. There's hundreds of people that are working on how to make these apps as addictive as possible, because the more people they get using them for a longer period of time, the more money the companies make. So yeah. I think the best way to fight back, instead of using your willpower and just saying to yourself, not going to check social media every hour or every 10 minutes or whatever it is, just delete the apps, because then you're not relying on willpower. And if you, say, only access them on a desktop, which is what I tend to do. At the moment, I do have Instagram on my phone, which is quite unusual. But I do find when I do have it on, I just get sucked in by it. Yep. But mostly it's not on my phone, nor is email, which was another thing that sucks me in. It's like it makes it so much easier to not succumb to digital distractions.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I have to try some of those things, like the rubber band, because even putting it in a different room sometime doesn't help. You still feel that pull towards it. And I feel like you should be in control of the phone, not letting the phone be in control of you.
That is the ideal situation. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I mean, look, there's another I think they're called brute force strategies in TimeWise. And I got this one from Tim Kendall, who used to be the president of Pinterest. And something he tried doing is he got this device called a K-Safe. And a K-Safe is actually a device originally used for people on a diet, where it's an opaque box and it's got a timer and a lock on it. And if you're on a diet, maybe chocolate is your vice, and so you put the chocolate into the K-Safe if you're having an urge to eat the chocolate.
Yeah.
And you set the timer for, you know, let's say an hour, maybe, for the urge to pass, and then the box will unlock itself after an hour. And so he started putting his phone in the box for about 6 o'clock at night to 8 in the morning, so that he could be really present with his family and not be tempted to check his phone.
Yeah.
So I love these strategies that they're not relying on willpower, because willpower is a limited resource, whereas, you know, unless you're pretty handy with breaking locks, a K-Safe is hard to get into.
No, that sounds like quite good, because, as you said, willpower is limited, and we can only make so many decisions in a day. So we often, if the phone's just lying there when we wake up, we just grab it instead of going through that nice morning routine that we've always wanted to do.
Exactly.
Yeah. Do you have any tips on setting like good morning and evening routines? Because I know people always write books and want to read about this type of thing.
Yeah. I mean, it's so funny, like all the articles. I mean, I click on them myself. Like, if I see an article, you know, the 52 things that
celebrities' morning routine
celebrities do before 5 a.m. or whatever, I'll be clicking on it. But look, I think it is really thinking about what works for you, and also thinking about, are you a morning person? In which case, having a morning routine is something that's going to be fairly easy to stick to, because you're not working against sleep inertia, which is that foggy feeling that you get if your alarm is waking you a little bit earlier than you would naturally wake. But look, I feel like Les has actually written about nighttime routines. And look, a nighttime routine that I have with my daughter that I find really good, and it's one of those things that's really stuck in my life, is, you know, I've obviously read a lot about the importance of gratitude, as I'm sure listeners have. We all know gratitude's important. It makes us, you know, feel happier and so on. So much research to support that. A lot of research to support writing a gratitude journal. And I have tried that many, many times, but I haven't been able to make it stick, even though I literally read research about habit change and behavior change every day of my life. It just does not stick. But something that did stick, I got this tip from Lisa Leong, who is the host of This Working Life and a good mate of mine. And she does a ritual with her family called Rosebud Thorn. And what this is a nightly ritual. She does it with her family. I do it with my daughter every night. And it's going through Rosebud and a Thorn. So a rose is something that is like the highlight of your day, something that you're really grateful for that happened during the day. The bud is something that you're looking forward to because it's a bud. It's, you know, growing in the future. And the thorn is something that is a stressor or a problem or something, you know, not great that that happened that maybe you want to ask for help with. And so I do that with my daughter every night. And I find that it's something that's stuck in terms of thinking about what am I really grateful for and what was the highlight of my day.
Do you think it's been easy to stick with that because you're doing the habit with someone else?
Yeah, I think that that does make it easier because it's ingrained in our evening ritual. So we will, you know, typically do bath time and then we'll go to bed and we'll be chatting in bed and then I'll be like, okay, Rosebud Thorn time. And then we do that and that's just, it's become quite ingrained in both of us. And then we do silent reading time where we'll both just sit in bed and read and then it's lights out. So yeah, I think, you know, having someone else to keep you accountable is also quite helpful with these things.
Yeah, because I know a lot of listeners with their finances, if they work together with their partner or a sibling or they find a friend to go with this through this journey with, it helps them stay on track because they've got someone to check in with their goals and their progress with and they're not just doing it alone.
Definitely. And I think that a lot of people are very motivated when there's some external point of accountability. I know that I find that quite helpful when I've said to someone, I'm going to do this by this date, I will always stick to it.
Well, now we've shared so many great tips and strategies in today's episode, but before we wrap up, I know you've spoken to so many people on your podcast, How I Work, and you've had such great conversations there. Are there any other strategies from you or some of your amazing guests that you wanted to share with my listeners?
I'll share one other one that I do use quite a lot. And I think it's relevant now that, you know, this year we've kind of been coming out of our caves of lockdown, particularly in Melbourne being the lockdown capital of the world. And we're going to events and it almost feels like we're relearning how to socialize and how to talk to people that we don't know. And I personally get quite nervous at events where I don't know anyone. And I got this strategy from Marissa King, who's a professor of social dynamics and social behavior at Yale. And this stuck with me and it is my go-to strategy whenever I'm going to an event where I don't really know anyone that well. So what she says is, firstly, it can be really easy when you walk into a room to see it as an ocean full of people. And she said, that's your first mistake. They're islands. People cluster in groups and generally quite small groups. And then she said, what you want to do, and this is the great part of the tip, is you want to look for the odd numbered groups. Okay. So people naturally communicate in dyads, so one-on-one, like we've got two ears, two eyes. We're designed to just communicate one-on-one. And so if there's, say, a group of three or a group of five, there'll always be at least one person on the outer. Definitely in a group of three, I find is easiest. There will be someone who is on the outer. And so if you can identify those odd numbered groups, go up to them, see if you can identify who's on the outer, and then it will be very natural to break off with that person and start a new conversation and feel comfortable in that conversation. So I always look for odd numbered groups whenever I go to events now.
That's such a good tip. I've never thought of that. Because, yeah, usually there's, if you do have a group, there's always someone that's nodding along and not actually talking in the conversation. So, that's a good strategy. Well, I'll have to give that a go. If any listeners have tried that, let me know. I'll be very interested to hear it. Now, if people want to keep working on getting back in control of their time and their life and feel a bit more in control now that we're out of lockdowns and we've got a bit more autonomy over our lives, where can they find a copy of your book, Timewise?
Yeah, so you can get Timewise really wherever you buy books from. And then How I Work, the podcast that the book is based on, is available probably on the app that you're listening to this podcast on right now.
Yes, yes, I'm sure it is. And I've heard there's signed copies at Dimmicks in Melbourne, so that's my favourite store.
Yes, there's lots of signed copies at a lot of Dimmicks stores.
Wonderful. Well, Amantha, thank you so much for joining me on the Australian Finance Podcast today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Australian Finance Podcast, where our mission is to improve the financial futures of all Australians. If you'd like to learn more, create a free account at rusk.com.au/account to download free episode workbooks, bonus resources, and take our amazing free personal finance courses.
You can also join our online community by following the link in the description. If you enjoyed the show, what we'd love is for you to leave us a snappy review on iTunes. And you can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Rask Australia. Kate and I are also on both of those channels. Finally, if you have any feedback, suggestions for episodes or guests to come on the show, or you just have a question for us, shoot us an email at podcast@rask.com.au. InvestSmart's portfolios are turning 10, and to celebrate, 10 InvestSmart boot camps are up for grabs. This self-paced online course is ideal for both seasoned investors and those who are just starting out. Valued at $99, you could win a spot on this highly rated course. To enter the competition and for terms and conditions, simply visit investsmart.com.au/win. Don't miss out on this chance to learn from experts and take your investing to the next level. Simply visit investsmart.com.au/win. Good luck. Thanks for listening to this podcast. Before you go, I wanted to share some things with you. Specifically, I wanted to tell you about the 10 ways that Rask could help you in 2024. As many of you know, Rask has grown to become one of the biggest investing and finance platforms in Australia. Across our podcasts, our websites, our memberships, and so on, we now engage around 200,000 Aussies. Which, considering we started in a humble lounge room on a Kmart desk, one of those old fake white wooden ones, I'm pretty ecstatic about where we are 6 years later. As part of becoming one of Australia's biggest platforms for wealth creation and preservation, we now have a very special position in the country in that we can bring you some of the best, most thoughtful, expert-driven ways to protect and grow your wealth. And I'm going to share some of those with you now. I've got 10 ways that we can potentially help you or match you with someone who can. The first thing that I want to tell you about is the biggest step we've ever taken at Rask, which is the launch of our Rask Invest platform. This is a platform that lets our team, led by me, invest for you, primarily through low-cost, diversified ETFs. We'll have three strategies at launch, and every investor who comes through can pick one of the three strategies, being a balanced strategy, a growth strategy, and a high growth strategy. The balanced strategy focuses on passive income, and the high growth strategy focuses on longer term compounding. You will find a link in your podcast player to register your interest. We will be taking off soon. Number two, if you prefer to DIY your investing, you can join me and over 4,000 members inside Rask Core. That's our full ETF and ASX share research membership community. You can join now and you'll get updated ETF portfolio recommendations every quarter, as well as ongoing ASX and global stock research. Every single month, we call them the All-Star Stocks. You get that alongside the ETF portfolios, as well as other members-only content. It's called Rask Core. Number three, our first ever partnership with a business other than our own was a business by the name of Blusk, which has since become Flint Group. Flint Group is led by Chris Bates and Christian Stevens, two of Australia's most highly regarded mortgage brokers. Already over 200 Rask community members have begun the Rask plus Flint Group mortgage broking process. You can click the link in your podcast player if you're refinancing, investing, a first home buyer, or whatever. You've probably heard Chris on the show many times. Number four, you can connect with our most trusted financial advisors. Whether you're 25 years old, just graduated uni, and looking to set yourself up, or approaching or in retirement, and you've got that nest egg you want to protect and generate a passive income from, you can get in contact with our trusted panel of financial advisors. You can find the link in your podcast player. It's there each and every week. Just click the thing that says financial planning. Number five, if you want specialist insurance advice, as Warren Buffett said, rule number one is don't lose money. And rule number two is don't forget rule number one. Insurance is vitally important, especially when it comes to your number one asset, you. Whether you're a single income household or a couple, and you just want to protect what would happen if. You want to protect your family if something goes wrong. You want to protect your spouse if you lose your job. You want to protect yourself if you hurt yourself on the weekend at footy. Insurance is a way to do that. And I think the best way to do insurance is through a financial planner. And there's a few reasons for that. But one of them is sometimes some insurers will only work with financial advisors, but they can also be your companion as you go through the sometimes daunting process of getting insurance done properly. Sometimes you might not even know, but you're not even covered, even though you think you are. So get the right advice. You'll find a link in the show notes to check that out. Number six, buying property. If you're like me and you're thinking of buying property in the next 12 months, or maybe you've already invested and you're looking to downsize, getting the right advice and being able to build wealth through property is a proven strategy. It might be one of the most contentious, but I think that we have one of Australia's best property coaches in our ranks. That is Pete Wargent. Pete is the host of the now super popular Australian Property Podcast by Rask, and he's also my analyst team's macro consultant. So if you're a member of RASCOR, you will have seen Pete's name around the traps. He's a property coach and buyer's agent, and he works with a select number of people each and every year. Just a note on this, this is not a commercial thing with Pete. Pete just has great services, so we offer them to the community. And when he fills up, he fills up. You can find out more about Pete's coaching in the show notes. Next up, tracking your portfolio for tax. I think you are, because I think you have to. So we've partnered with Nevexa to help you manage your share and ETF reporting, whether it's tax or performance. All RASC users get 20% off an annual plan with Nevexa. You can sync your portfolio with Nevexa's software, and it automatically tracks your dividends, your capital gains tax, and more. Again, not a commercial partnership. We don't make anything from working with Nevexa, but they do create some great tools which the RASC community uses each and every day. Number eight, want to run your own business? Maybe you already do. If you want more profit, but less stress, less time consumed, and less energy lost, get in contact. We have a partner business called Inflection. The Inflection Accelerator Program is a complete online course that helps you and a community of members engage and follow a proven strategy for growing your business. I'm grateful to be one of the coaches inside the Accelerator program, helping business owners right across Australia. You can find more following the link in your podcast player. It's the one that says coaching. Number nine, if you haven't already checked it out, join over 20,000 other people who tune into the RASC YouTube channel. It is completely free and you get notified when we go live and when we publish podcast episodes. There is a podcast on the RASC network each and every day, as well as bite-sized material that's less than 60 seconds, or those really punchy tutorials and webinars that are just 15 minutes that take you through a really exciting topic, whether it's how to buy a property, whether it's how to pick a dividend ETF. Some of our most popular content actually just explains things like, what the heck is franking credits and how do I calculate if I've got some? That's on our YouTube channel. Number 10, if you want to be a better investor, a saver, a better partner with money, or just understand your own relationship with money, you can do that. All of that by going to the RASC Education website and taking a free course. We've enrolled over 26,000 students at the time of this recording, and we are on a mission to get to 100,000 in the next few years. RASC Education is our mostly free education platform, covering everything from budgeting and automation to the probably, I would say, the best value investing program in the country. So whether you're a value investor, an intermediate investor, you want to know how to value Woolworths shares, or you simply just want to understand what ethical investing is, or buy your first property and what actually happens on settlement day, head to the RASC Education website and enroll in something today. It is free and it supports us, because then I can come on here next month and I can say we've got 27,000. And hopefully we reach critical mass where we can help more Australians manage their money better. Thank you for listening to this long-winded ad. If you want to get in contact with me, you know where to go. There's a link in your show notes. Basically, these 10 services, even though some of them we don't make any money from, support RASC and allow us to produce these podcasts, attract the biggest and best guests from Australia and around the world, and bring them to you to answer your questions. Thank you for being part of the RASC network, and thank you for your ongoing support. Bye for now.